Good morning. So last time we talked about hazards. We mentioned hazards was something where a pipeline processor does the wrong thing without changes. But when we did our, separate the stages, add the pipeline registers, we ended up with not getting the right answer for some reason. And this was caused by some dependencies between instructions, which meant that just sometimes, our pipeline would get some wrong value or have some value that's not available. We talked in particular detail about data hazards. So data hazards are where we read an outdated value from a register because adding pipelining changed the order in which we read and write things to registers. And we talked about a couple different solutions to this. Sort of our simplest one was this idea of stalling, that we'll add knobs in between the dependent instructions to delay the instruction that would have read the outdated value until after the write happens, until it would read after the write happens. And we mentioned that we could have this be done manually by the compiler or whoever's writing the assembly, but more realistically, we'd add some logic to the processor that would insert these knobs dynamically. It would say, oh, we're fetching this instruction. This instruction can't really run yet, so I'm just going to hold this instruction in the fetch stage and send some dummy work down to decode until it's ready. Then we talked about a better solution, which was forwarding. And the idea there was, even though we haven't written out the value we need to the register file, we often have still computed it. And we can take advantage of that. We can add a wire connecting the place where the computed value is to the place where we would read the value. And we can substitute the value we would read from the register file for that computed value from that future stage. Now, we don't always want to do this because we don't always have a dependency. So we're going to have a mux, which, depending on whether there is that dependency or not, is going to either select that new value or not. And if you did the lab yesterday, you implemented one forwarding case for our example of a two-stage processor with very simple instructions. And in the HCL 6 and 8 assignments, you'll do a whole bunch more. So questions about things we covered last time? OK, so some logistical notes. There's no lab next week. That schedule is correct. There's a quiz due Thursday, instead of Tuesday. Yes. The question is, will the quiz come out late? No, the quiz will come out tonight. Other questions? Okay, so when we finished up last time, we mentioned the one case in our five-stage pipeline where forwarding isn't enough to resolve a data hazard. And that's where we're reading a value from memory and using it in the next stage to compute something and execute. So, what you'd want to do the forwarding where we sent it from execute to decode, but that's not possible because if we're looking for the value of RBX here, RBX hasn't been computed yet. So our solution is going to be that we're going to delay the subtract instruction by one cycle. We're going to stall for one cycle and use forwarding. If we only use stalling, we'd end up doing a whole bunch more stalling because we need to stall to do this path here, right? To make it so it's written so we can read it. So we still save a bunch of cycles by doing forwarding, but we're going to have to combine it with stalling to actually resolve this data hazard. And I'm showing this for an MR move queue. This applies for any time we're reading a value from memory and then using it in execute in a later instruction. And this is what we're going to have you implement in some of the later HCL assignments. Questions about this situation, which I mentioned last time, is called in our textbook, is called the load use hazard. Yes?
We haven't learned how to actually implement stalling yet, have
we? We haven't talked about how to implement stalling yet. That is correct. Okay. Other questions? I guess we talked about it at a very high level, but we haven't talked about the details. Other questions? Okay, so this is a case where I have to do stalling and forwarding. There's one variant that looks similar to this where that's not actually necessary, and that's if we're reading a value in memory and then not actually computing on it in the following instruction until after memory. Until after execute. So for example, MR move queue followed by R move queue, we could technically forward from memory to the end of execute. This means we have to add a whole nother mux for this, in addition to our muxes in the decode stage, to support this. And this is something that your textbook's processor doesn't do, and that we're not going to have you do in the HCL assignments, to be consistent with the textbook. But real processors do this because, well, people often write code where they load something from memory and store it back. So it's worth implementing this extra shortcut and adding the extra mux to do it. And it doesn't change the cycle time very much because it's a mux at the end of the clock cycle. So it's not going to affect performance that much. So questions about this sort of special case? I guess I should mention that our textbook doesn't implement it, and in the assignments, we will not check if you implement it. I've selected our tests in a way where you should be able to implement this or not implement this and still pass. So, a note about forwarding. So some people might be tempted to say, wait. So, why can't we do... why do we need to stall here? Why can't we do this forwarding path here? And, what that would look like in our circuit is that we'd have our decode to execute and our execute to memory, and we'd have our data memory, and we'd have our ALU, and we just, rather than sending the value to a mux before the decode to execute registers, you say, we could just send it from here, into a mux like here. So why don't we do that? Anyone have an idea? What's the problem here? Yeah.
From the end to the beginning of a stage, so it increases cycle time too much.
Yeah. So this is going to increase the cycle time a lot because now we have a new critical path, and our new critical path is going to be from these pipeline registers through the data memory and through the ALU, which kind of defeats the point of having the execute and memory stages be separate. So this is why we're always forwarding to the end of a stage. Questions? About this issue, about our muxes you know, are adding to the critical path, but it's important that we don't, you know, try to be, you know, just take other shortcuts that are going to dramatically increase our critical path. Okay, so when I talked about hazards, I mentioned that our hazards depend on what pipeline we have. So, for example, in our five-stage pipeline, R8 creates a hazard between the add and the and here. If we had a four-stage pipeline, let's say we combined executed memory into one stage, we said, oh, the ALU and the data memory are pretty fast, we should put them together, then we'd end up with something that is not a hazard. And this is going to be a big consideration when we decide what stages to divide our processor into, because you know, sometimes we're going to have to do stalling, so on, depending on, to run our instructions, you know, run our programs, and that's going to affect our processor's performance. So let's do an exercise on this topic. So let's say I have something where I split the execute stage into two pieces. Like so. And I run these instructions. And my question is, where are we going to do forwarding installs? So let's assume that we're doing the best forwarding installing we can do without violating that rule of dramatically increasing our critical path. And we're going to combine forwarding installing to resolve data hazards if, you know, that's if we can't just use forwarding. So I'll give you a few minutes to go through this. So I recommend writing out what's in what cycle, and then drawing lines like we've shown where forwarding happens. And a good way to start out is to look at where are our dependencies. So for example, the first instruction one writes to R9, which is read by instruction 2. It also writes, R9 is read by instruction 3, so that's another dependency. And instruction 3 writes to R9, and that value is read by instruction 4. Though it's not read by instruction 5. And there's some other dependencies I haven't drawn yet. So I assume people aren't done, but let's do instruction 2. So can someone tell me any volunteers tell me what forwarding or stalling should happen for instruction 2? So for the second instruction, you say you need the memory parts. So what line should I draw for forwarding? Or so first of all, let's start with the beginning. So you're telling me, so do we need stalling?
Yeah.
Okay. So how does that stalling look like? So we fetch and we have to wait, right? So we're not going to be able to decode yet. For one cycle, two cycles? We can do the stalling either way. So we could, if we think of how this is going to work in the processor, we definitely have to fetch the instruction. There's a question of whether it moves on from there. So one model we could have, yes, is that we fetch, and then we fetch again. Okay, so that's fine. So is it going to be fetching again one time? And then we'll have decode, execute, right back. Is that what you think?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay, and what forwarding happens?
So the memory goes into execute one.
Okay, so you want to draw a line from memory to execute one, like here? Okay, so the problem I have here is that we probably need the value of R9 at the beginning of XQ1. So not so the place where I do forwarding would be to the end of decode. Now, I think the stalling is correct, because observe, what we need to do is we can't start execute one of the add until we have the value of R9. And the earliest I can get the value of R9 is the end of execute two of instruction one. So I had to have one cycle of stalling to make them align that way. So questions on how I came up with this answer? Yes. So the question is the first execute stage R9 matter. So if you want to forward, the way we've implemented forwarding, we've always forwarded to some mux that's just before the pipeline registers. So if we do that in execute one, then that means for the first part of the execute one stage, the value of R9 won't be available for instruction two. And that, presumably, if we're dividing execute into two pieces, we kind of need the values at the beginning of the first piece, otherwise we could just remove a stage. Does that answer your question? Okay. Now I could imagine implementing forwarding where we, instead of putting the mux just before the pipeline registers, we put it just after, in which case, yes, I would draw a line from M to E1, but I would draw it at the beginning of the stage, not at the end. Yes? So is there a difference between forwarding to a mux that's just before pipeline register versus just after? Basically, no. There's an issue with when we've seen forwarding to the from the write-back stage that there's no pipeline register after it, which is the primary reason that we are forwarding to the end of stages. Other questions? Okay. So we have then the next instruction, and one thing we know about it is that it can't be fetched until after that stall. So that's a common thing people don't remember, is that if you stall, we're still executing instructions in order, so the next instruction is going to be delayed no matter what. So does this next instruction need stalling to happen? Who thinks yes it does? Okay. Who thinks no it doesn't? Okay. So we have consensus that, well, not consensus, but close to consensus that it doesn't. So let's look at why that might be the case. So what I'll do is I'll write out with correct alignment. The stages that this is going to go through. And what I need is I need RAX and R9 to be available at the beginning of E1. RAX, that's going to come from the registers. We don't see anything that else it could come from. For R9, it has to come from the instruction 1's result. But that's not going to be a problem because we can forward it from the end of that instruction 1's memory to the end of instruction 3's decode that has been relocated by stall. Can I forward from what?
End of E2 to add in cycle
3. Can I forward from the end of E2 to add in cycle 3? Okay, so that gets to our next instruction. So with the forwarding that our textbook implemented, we have, I guess I have our diagram for this, so I can just show that. So we have the forwarding we've seen so far. So then now we're at our R move queue. So the question is, how does the R move queue get the value of R9? And what we've seen so far in this example is we need the value in time for execute 1. But for R move queue needs the value of RBX in time for execute 1 because it's going to compute 0 plus RBX. But the value of R9, it doesn't need until memory. So it needs the value here, and the value is going to come from instruction 3 here. It's not going to come from instruction 1 because instruction 1 is the old version of R9. So if we wanted to get it from instruction 3, we could do this forwarding path. So that's extra mux we'd have to implement to support this without stalling. But it's a big win here versus otherwise we have to stall for 2 cycles. So we'll add that. Oh, right, and I forgot the other example. So for RBX, we need the value of RBX in time for E1, and RBX was computed by instruction 2, so we're going to forward that to the end of decode. Then we have the R move queue where there is no forwarding. And I'd say, wait a moment. But the value of R9 hasn't been written out yet by the time we're reading it. Isn't that a problem? No, it isn't, because the R move queue doesn't need the value of R9. It's going to overwrite R9 without caring what it was before. Some questions about this exercise? Yes?
Could you explain
So the question is, why am I forwarding to the end of E2 for R9 to RM move Q? So if we think of what RM move Q is doing with the value of R9, it's not manipulating the value in any way during execute. All that we're doing is passing that, you know, from the register file to the data memory. And we can add a mux to substitute that with the correct value anywhere in that passing process, and things will work fine as long as we do it before it makes it to the data memory.
So would it still work to stall and then forward?
Questions, would it still work to stall and forward? Absolutely. That would just not be the fastest way we could implement our processor. Was a question over here? Okay, back there. So what if instead the last last stage was R move Q R9 RCX? So if the last stage was R move Q R9 RCX, if we were clever, we could realize that, oh, we're just passing the value of R9 through and forward from, actually, even if we weren't clever, we can forward from the end of XQ2 to the end of decode. If it was a move of R9 instead of a move of RCX. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So you're going one forward path from R9 to R9 from 3 to 4, but actually the instrument needs two wires, one for the data, one for the address, right?
So the question is, for going from 3 to 4, we need two wires.
Yeah.
So in this picture, for the forwarding we have here, we have forwarding from instruction 2 and instruction 3 at the same time for different register values. When we do our implementation, if we're implementing all that forwarding to the end of XQ2 to handle R move Q and presumably also push Q, then we're going to have a mux with a whole bunch of cases for every single stage you could forward from, you know, at the end of decode for both RA and RB, and a similar mux at the end of XQ2. So in terms of like the HCL code you're writing, this gets pretty complicated. And that's part of why our textbook simplifies things by ignoring the case of forwarding after decode to after decode. Yeah.
For your second instruction, your stall, you put 2D code.
Okay, yeah, so I wrote the stall differently. So one way we could do the stall is we could have the instruction have its values be sent to the decode pipeline registers, and we could detect there, oh, I can't move on. I'm just going to keep this instruction here, and I'm going to send a signal to cause the fetch stage to keep its instruction there. So both are correct ways of implementing a stall, and often keeping it into code is more practical because we have the information we need to know a stall should happen in a better form than we'd have it in fetch. Or in a more general case, maybe like if our fetch takes a while, we might not have it otherwise, and we would need to wait to decode to figure out, oh, I can't advance this instruction. So that's why I'm showing it being stuck into code. So, you know, we could keep the instruction in the code as long as we make sure we somehow tell the fetch stage, hey, sorry, the thing you fetched, you're going to have to try again next time. Can't move it on to the code. Yeah?
Can I explain a little bit about the E2 to E4?
Can I explain the E2 to... So the E2 to E is for RBX, because we need to get it to compute the address. So it looks like maybe we could delay that to later, but remember that we're computing, this instruction is, you know, is really computing 0 plus RBX. So unless we have a special case for 0, we're going to have to forward it to there anyways. We're going to use it for computing the address. So that's what that first forwarding line is, from the second instruction's E2 to the end of decode for the RM move Q. And this other forwarding path is for R9, the value we're writing to the memory, which we don't do any computations on. Yeah?
So for this whole thing, was there just one stall, or was it two?
Question is, was there just one stall or was there two? There was just one stall. A way you can think about that is we took it, the total number of cycles we took is just one more than if there was no stall. Yeah. So the question is, wait, I'm duplicating the stages of two different instructions. How is that one stall? So when we count a number of stalls, we're counting the number of times we keep instructions from advancing. And if we're keeping an instruction from advancing into code or execute or so on, there's going to be a bunch of instructions stuck behind it. We still call that one stall. Yeah. And in the fourth line, why would there not be two Fs there? So where do you mean by two Fs? Like here? Because that would mean that during cycle three, we'd have two things being finished, which is not possible. Does that answer your question? Yeah, I guess a key way of checking when you make diagrams like this, if they're correct, is if when you go down every time, you should see at most one thing in a stage. And you should also be suspicious if you don't see a stage occupied that's in the middle of this. Like, because there should be something needs to be there, like a knob. Yes?
You also need to implement the box for the register source selection that for this Y bit, right?
So we need to implement the box for the register source selection for...
For the
input to the register file, yes, but I don't think that's changed for this, but because we added this. Okay, so talked a bunch about resolving data hazards with forwarding. Let's talk about our next big problem, which is control hazards. So a control hazard, we do something like a conditional jump, and in our pipeline, we don't have the information available to actually compute the result of the jump. And you might say, wait a minute, we just use the condition codes, right? But if we think about this program here, we subtract R8 from R9, and we do a jump equals. So remember, subtract works is the same computation as compare. So during cycle 2, we should be fetching from 0x12, the instruction after the jump, the add, if R8 doesn't equal R9, and OXFFF otherwise, but we haven't actually retrieved the value of R8 and R9. Well, we've just retrieved it. We haven't had enough time to do any sort of subtraction yet by the time we need to make this decision. Right, so we're preparing to do the subtraction, but when we're doing the subtraction, we're trying to fetch based on the result of that. So there's no trick which is going to get us out of this. And in our natural pipeline, if we just look at the values of the condition codes, well, first of all, they're part of the execute stage. So we haven't read them yet for the jump instruction, because the jump instruction hasn't made it to the execute stage. And secondly, they aren't set right yet. So this is known as a control hazard. So one way of resolving our control hazard here is with stalling. We can say, okay, we're going to wait for SF and ZF to be updated, and then we're going to actually run the jump instruction, you know, using the SF and ZF from the execute stage. We'll go into more detail what this looks like later. So this is a possible way of resolving it, but it's going to require two cycles of stalling to implement. So that's going to be an annoyance for us, because we have to wait for us to, you know, have the SF and ZF set correctly before we can actually compute where the jump goes. So sort of a better version of that diagram would be something like this. That the way I like picturing it is that, we want the jump to get to execute before we can figure out what to fetch. And that conceptually, rather than the jump computing the PC update in fetch, it needs to compute it in execute. But to make that work, we need to do stalling. And why do I say it's computing in execute? Because execute is where our condition codes live. And we're always going to follow the rule of always using the condition codes in the execute stage. And why is this a good idea? Because it means that we never have to worry about, am I reading an old or new old version of the condition codes or not? I'm not, because I made it to the execute stage, which means the instruction just before me is in memory now, so it wrote the condition codes. There's no problem. We can also use this stalling solution for return. Return, we don't have condition codes to worry about, but we have a similar hazard issue, which is that we need to load an address from memory and then fetch that address. And you might say, well, maybe we could do that load early, but in the worst case, we can't. So just like with the jump, we need the subtraction could happen that cycle before if we didn't do two cycles of stalling. Well, after we did two cycles of stalling, with the return, we could have the value we are trying to read be stored the cycle before. The return would get to memory. So we need to have the return wait till it gets to memory, which means that we'd have to stall for three cycles in order to figure out what to retrieve. So questions about these stalling cases? Yeah.
How
do I tell how many cycles I need? So I figure out when I can load the return address. And if we're following the rule that we only access the data memory in the memory stage, that's going to have to be when the return instruction can make it from fetch to memory. Because in the worst case, every instruction before that could be writing to the memory, so the data memory, or reading from the data memory, so it might not be available. So that means I need to plan to wait, you know, three cycles for it to advance to memory. And because the data memory takes a while to read, I can't also read the instruction in the same cycle. I need to wait till the next cycle. Otherwise, I'm going to make my critical path really long. I'm going to have to do a read from the data memory and the instruction memory in one cycle, which means my cycle time is going to be really long. Questions about, yes? So the question is, could I use forwarding for this? So this is another case of forwarding path problem. So if I think of my execute to memory, I have my data memory, and I have my fetch stage with my instruction memory, and the forwarding you seem to be proposing would be that we'd, you know, send this value directly into the instruction memory. And that would mean my critical path. That's not what I wanted. Critical path is now this whole thing. It includes the data memory and the instruction memory. So, no, we can't do forwarding. That's going to save us a cycle. Other questions? Yeah.
So,
questions. How do we know when forwarding is going to be clickable? So, when we've done forwarding, we've always forwarded to the end of a cycle. So, for sending the value from the return to our fetch stage, that would be we're forwarding to the thing to the PC register, not to after the PC register, because that's the beginning of the cycle.
Okay.
And this is assuming effectively we're sending it as if we were sending it to right next to the PC register, not, you know, right before the PC register if we're sending it during memory, or right after the PC register if we're sending it during returns write back. Other questions? Okay, so we talked about doing stalling, and we learned that with stalling, we had up to 3 cycles with our 5-cycle processor. Up to 3 cycles, we'd have to wait for data dependencies. And now, for every return, we need an extra 3 cycles, meaning that a return is going to take 4 cycles to execute. We need an extra 2 cycles for a conditional jump, meaning a conditional jump is going to take 3 cycles to execute. But for our data dependencies, we learned that we had this trick of forwarding that dramatically reduced this penalty. So a natural question to ask is there something similar we can do for return and conditional jump? And there are things that we can do that are going to help us avoid these stalls for return or conditional jump, but they're not going to look like our forwarding solution, because fundamentally, in the worst case, the value just isn't going to be available earlier. So I'm going to first talk about how we're going to deal with conditional jumps. And to think about that, we're going to make an observation about when things change in our pipeline. So during our fetch stage, we don't actually change anything. We're doing a bunch of work to retrieve an instruction, but nothing actually changes. During our decode stage, we read some register values, but we don't actually change any state of the processor. And during execute memory write back, that's when we start actually editing values. And why I'm bringing this up is that this means that if we have an instruction that we started running that's in the fetch or decode stage, it hasn't actually done anything yet. So if we made a mistake and ran the wrong instructions, we can undo that instruction by just dropping our values from pipeline registers. There's no other work to do, because the instruction hasn't actually changed anything important. So this means that it's really easy to start doing a fetch and decode for instructions, even if, you know, they're not correct. And we can take advantage of this for conditional jumps, because this is going to allow us to make guesses. And you might say, well, if we're making guesses, how can we ever execute a program correctly? And this is telling us that we have a really easy way of fixing our wrong guess as long as we don't make the instruction go to execute memory or write back. If it's only in fetch and decode, fixing the guess is just ignore the values in the pipeline registers. If it gets to execute memory or write back, probably we could undo the instruction, but we have to do a lot of extra bookkeeping to do that. So what we're going to do for our guesses is we're going to guess that conditional jumps go to their destination. And if we're right, we're going to save 2 cycles of stalling. What about if we're wrong? Well, if we're wrong, we're going to run 2 instructions and get rid of them. So we're going to waste 2 cycles, which is what we were planning on doing originally. So what we ended up with is when we speculate correctly, we're going to fetch based on assuming the jump goes to the destination. So we're going to fetch, in this case, the add and the rmove queue. And rather than stalling, rather than doing nops or waiting, and then when our jump makes it to execute and can read the condition codes, we're going to say, oh, yep, great, did it. And in fact, we're not going to do any extra work. It's going to be simpler than implementing the jump with stalling. In this case. or in the correct case. Sorry, I should show the right slides. Now, so this is the case where we speculate correctly. We don't do any extra work. We just have some instructions we guessed. But while they were guesses, they didn't make it beyond a code, so nothing really dangerous happened. So what if we guessed wrong? So in this case, we want to execute the XOR after the jump rather than going to add. Well, in that case, we're going to fetch the add and the rmoveq. And the add is going to make it to R. So we have the rmoveq and fetch, the add into code. And then we're going to look at our jump and say, OK, what's going to happen here? Oh, this jump, in fact, isn't taken. We want to go to the XOR instead. So we're going to make two corrective measures. So our first corrective measure is we're going to do what I'll call squashing these wrong guesses. So these instructions that we guessed that were wrong, we're going to eliminate them from our pipeline register. So rather than passing add from decode to execute, we're going to pass a not from decode to execute. So the implementation of this might be we have a mux where we decide between do we send the real value or do we send a nup? And the same thing for rmoveq from fetch to decode. Do we send the real value or do we send a nup? We're going to decide to send a nup because, oh, this instruction was a mistake. We made a wrong guess. And we're going to have some extra logic to, rather than fetching the instruction after the rmoveq, to fetch the thing after the jump. So we're going to have stashed the address of that XOR somewhere, and we'll retrieve it and send it to the PC, to the instruction memory. So questions about this process for dealing with an incorrect guess? Yes?
So really, you just have to, besides like squashing the instruction, you just have to update the PC to like the jump, and then if you're wrong 2 cycles later, you'll just update it back.
Yeah, so our process question is, we update the PC to the jump, and if we're wrong, when we find out, we update it to the correct value? Yeah. So it's that plus dealing with undoing wrong instructions. Yes?
Would we also use squashing for conditional move?
The question is, would we also use squashing for a conditional move? And no. And the reason why is that the conditional move doesn't have a control or a control hazard. Right. There's no part of a conditional move where we decide to fetch the wrong instruction. So what we're doing in a conditional move generally is we're just going to compute what the destination register is in the conditional moves execute. We aren't doing this thing where we're affecting other instructions, like our conditional jump is. Yes? So the question is, how do we make this logic for fetching the XOR instead of what's after the rmoveq? So what our textbook proposes is that before the instruction memory, we have a mux, where either we take the value from the PC or the value from a pipeline register for the conditional jump. Does that answer your question? Yeah. The question is, if we guess wrong, we'll be 2 cycles slower, and if we guess right, we'll be the normal speed? Yes. Back there? The question is, what if label is a lot longer?
Yeah, like the functions
code. The code and label? So I'm showing two instructions at label, but there are going to be more here. So there might be like an and so on. It doesn't matter because we only have 2 cycles of guessing. So we're only going to fetch the first 2 instructions. So it doesn't matter how much stuff there is there. We'll only have time before we figure out the real result of a jump to the first 2 instructions. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. The question, in this case, we're guessing the next instructions, the add at the label. But if we're wrong, we're going to the XOR, yes. And the reason we're going to the XOR is that the instruction after the jump is the same thing if the jump was a not that we've run. Yes? Question is, why are conditional moves not control hazards? So a control hazard is we don't know what instruction to fetch. For a conditional move, we're fetching an instruction. We know what it is. It's this conditional move instruction. So that's not a control hazard. And as far as dependencies and other instructions, the conditional move doesn't have those sorts of problems as long as it can get, well, yeah, so it might have data hazards with respect to the things being moved, but as far as the condition goes, it just gets to advance to execute, read the condition codes, and decide what to write based on that. Yes?
So the condition codes only get checked and executed, right? So how would you know, how would you tell the fetch and decode stages if you're wrong and update those?
So the question is, since we're checking our condition codes and execute, how do we tell the fetch and decode stages what to do? We are going to have a bunch of signals that go between stages. And this is a case where that's going to be okay because we're deliberately trying to control what other instructions do. The reason I gave you the rule about not doing that is because if you aren't trying to control what other instructions do, it's going to give you the wrong answer. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, this is on average faster than stalling? Yeah, so let's, and it depends on what instructions we run. So let's say we have, here's a mix of instructions. So let's say we have non-taken jumps are 3% of our instructions. Taken jumps are 5% of our instructions. Returns are 1%, and other instructions are 91%. And if we're doing this prediction, this guessing, which we'll call prediction, then the non-taken ones take 3 cycles in effect. We have 2 cycles of stalling plus 1 cycle it would normally take. Our taken ones take 1 cycle in effect. We have 1 cycle it normally takes, and then we fetch the right thing right away. I guess we don't have 2 cycles of stalling. We have 2 cycles of fetching the wrong thing. And return takes 4 cycles with stalling. So 3 cycles of stalling and 1 normal cycle. Versus if we only do stalling, our jump takes 3 cycles, 2 cycles of stalling, regardless of the results. So let's do the exercise of how does this help performance. So compute our cycles per instruction for each of these cases. So cycles per instruction is a way of is a kind of measurement of throughput. Okay, so like people are working. So who can tell me, how do I get started with computing the cycles per instruction with prediction? What's the first thing I should do? Yeah. So your idea, which is what I agree with, is that we say, oh, 3% of our instructions take 3 cycles, so we're going to do this weighted average to figure out the average number of cycles each takes. So 3% times 3, 5% times 1, where by 3% I mean 0.03, as you said, so on. So we can do that for our predict and our stall, and probably you'd want a calculator for this. So these are the numbers I got. So I said prediction, we have 3 times 0.03 for not taken, 1 times 0.05 for taken, 4 times 0.01 for returns, and 1 times 0.91 for everything else. And since we've accounted for all the instructions, this will be our average cycles per instruction over everything, which is about 1.09, versus with stalling, we do the same calculation, and the only difference is that the effective time for a taken jump is 2 cycles longer, we get 1.19. And if we think of overall performance, this means that our new processor is about 10% faster by doing prediction. And this might not be an intuitive result, because you look at our prediction and it seems like, well, first of all, it's jumps are 8% of our instructions, right? So you might look at that and say, oh, if jumps are only 8% of our instructions, why are we spending our time optimizing them? But because of the stalling or wasted cycles we need, they affect our performance a lot. Another thing you might look at is you might say, our prediction is right about 5/8 of the time. Like, we're guessing, and we're just barely better than a coin flip. And that's fine, we're still gonna get a big win. So questions about this computation? So we've talked about stalling and prediction. We talked about stalling and what we'll call branch prediction. So a question that came up is, like, how are we going to implement this in HCLRS? And there's going to be some tools that HCLRS provides that are common operations that happen when we want to implement stalling or squashing, which are two big funny operations. And to do this, let's think about sort of the sort of things we're doing when we're stalling. So one thing we might want to do is we want to keep an instruction in the fetch stage, or keep an instruction in, say, the decode stage. So I'm going to talk about our case. If we go back to here, so we had this case. Let's think about what happens during here. Right, we're keeping an instruction in the code, instruction stays in fetch behind it, and something is also going to need to happen to execute, which we'll talk about. So one thing we need to do to implement that is we need to keep an instruction in the code. So how are we going to do that? We want to keep the pipeline registers that go from fetch to decode the same. So we're going to have a mux where we feed back the output of the registers back into them. You know, if we should, well, I'll call stall the decode stage. So another part of stalling is that we might want to send a pipeline bubble. So remember when we talked about stalling originally, we mentioned that when we stall, when we keep something in the fetch or decode stage, the later stages, they have to do something. We have to send something there. So we're going to send the values for a NOOP. So we need a pipeline register to have some mux that says, sometimes we send a NOOP value, sometimes we don't. And we'll call this operation bubbling. And this is something we're going to have to do a bunch with our pipeline because we have a couple different stall cases we're going to have to implement. So we're going to have to deal with a load use hazard. That's a piece of case where we need to stall. We have to stall for return. We have to do squashing for conditional jumps. And this operation is handy for that. Why is that? Well, if we look back at what we did when we speculated wrong, we needed to end up with nothing in decode and execute. This mux is going to do exactly that. It's going to put a NOOP there instead of what we had before. And you could write these muxes by hand, but HCLRS has sort of a convenience feature for this, which we recommend because if you think of how this works, if you're writing this by hand, you're passing like five different values from fetch to decode. And now you have to implement five different muxes to do it for this and five different ones for this and so on. It's going to get really tedious. So the register banks in HTLRS have these muxes built in for you. They're already implemented, and they're called stall and bubble. So the stall ones are the ones where we keep the old values, where we send the value back into the input. And the bubble ones are the ones where we replace it with the default values. So if you follow the convention of your defaults being values for a NOOP, that will insert a pipeline bubble when you trigger those muxes. And these muxes are controlled by a signal called stall and a signal called bubble for everything in the register bank. So no matter how many registers I declare, they'll all work. They'll all be controlled by those same two signals, and they're always named after the output of the register. So questions? Yes, back there.
So this is default value, that means the value that you initialize.
Questions, default mean the value you initialize? Yes, so if I have, so I should write an actual equals, well, I don't know why. Foo, it would be the foo here. Other questions? So let's look at how that works. So fill in the table here. So here during time one, I'm showing you the value of A value, B value, stall B, bubble B. These are the values you would see if like you took out HCLRS with the debug flag. Question is, what does capital B value end up being? So we're going to want to know this so then we can correlate it later on to how does this work with our, you know, the stalling and bubbling we want to do, so we can think about that. The stalling whole instructions or with squashing that we're going to want to do. So I would probably write things down, but I guess, to start you off, if you remember, the way our registers work is during one cycle, you input to the input wires, which are the lowercase letter, and the normal operation, which is what's going to happen when stolen bubble are zero, is that we pass that value on to the output during the next cycle, so I can fill in that this first value is 0x01. Because during cycle one, during cycle zero, that value is passed in, and there was nothing telling it to not be passed normally because stolen bubble were both set to zero. Note that it doesn't matter what that stall is set in the next cycle, because that's, you know, something in the future can't affect things in the past. So it was set after we actually stored a value for cycle. Okay, who'd like more time? Okay, a few people. So let's start with the next one. So for the next one, normally, during cycle two, during time two, we'd have the two that was stored at time one. But we're not going to store two at time one because the stall signal is set. And the stall signal is going to override that. So remember, it controls amux like this. So rather than taking our normal value, we're not going to do that. We're going to take the value that it was outputting. So we're going to end up keeping B value the same, because basically we're going to be feeding B value into A value, replacing the normal A value because of that stall signal. Okay, so questions so far? So then we look at what's going to be stored during time two. During time two, the input is 3. The output's 1, but that doesn't matter because the stall and bubble signals are both 0. So we're just going to do the normal thing, the same thing we did during at time 0, and store the input and make it the output during the next cycle. So we end up with 3. Then during time 3, well, normally we'd store 4. But the bubble signal is set, so we're going to replace that 4 we normally store with the default value, which is 0xff. Then things operate normally. It doesn't matter that we're outputting 0xff. What matters is the input. The input's 5. That's what's going to be stored. And the same thing during the next cycle. The input's 6. and that's going to be stored normally. Then our stall signal is sent. So we're inputting 7. Normally we'd store 7, but stall says instead replace it with what's being output right now, which is 6. So we're going to keep 6. And during time 7, we're going to do the same thing. We're going to keep the 6 because the stall signal is still set. We're going to ignore that the 8's coming in. Doesn't matter. So we're going to still do 6. So we end up with this. So questions about this? Yes.
Really quick, do you mind explain the diagram of which relates to
the... the muxes? So this is the... So this signal is... would be stall D, and this one would be bubble D.